Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the show today by talking about movement disorders with our guest, Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent. She's a neurologist and the director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. And as we talk with Dr. Bouillon-Dent, I hope you'll join in. Do you or someone you care about have a movement disorder? Let us know about the questions you have about treatments, perhaps. We'll take your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again. This is always a fun thing
it's
to
fun
do.
Fun to have you back. How would you define movement disorders?
Yeah, movement disorders are neurologic problems. Difficulties with the brain and the nerves and spine that will result in various types of abnormal movements that can be impairing. One of the major things that we see are people with Parkinson's disease.
That's the most common of those?
That's the most common, right. And this happens to be, Parkinson's Awareness Month.
Yep.
And on April 11th, it's actually World Parkinson's Day, as that's Dr. James Parkinson's birthday, the person who this disease is named after.
And the symptoms, I mean, movements.
Right. Yeah, there's really four classic symptoms. There's a certain type of tremor that people may develop that can affect usually their upper extremities or their arms or their legs. Also, they'll develop a certain type of slowness of movement. To the individual experiencing this, it might feel like a certain type of weakness. And then their movements can get very, very slow. Eventually, people may develop some walking difficulties. They'll tend to fall down a fair amount. And those are the main classic symptoms.
Voice changes?
There can be voice changes as well. A very soft voice might develop. Sometimes some swallowing difficulties as well.
So what do we know about what causes movement disorders, Parkinson's?
Right. Yeah, that's the million or billion dollar question. The current thinking is that there is likely a genetic predisposition. There's been several genes that have been associated with development of Parkinson's disease. And then some other things seem to need to happen to trigger it. So just having the gene in the majority of people does not seem to me cause or guarantee that you're going to be symptomatic. However, we think that something else has to happen to you, either a toxin exposure, maybe even a virus or some other factor that we don't know. And that triggering thing may be different for different individuals.
Yeah. Is it more prevalent in one sex versus the other?
Somewhat more prevalent in men.
Kevin called, couldn't stay with us. He's got a REM behavior sleep disorder, and he's seen studies that say there's a 70 to 80% chance of developing movement disorders like Parkinson's, and wonders if you've heard about that.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of research going on trying to find an earlier marker of Parkinson's. Currently, we diagnose it by history and clinical exam. We can see certain things on a neurologic exam. However, there have been numerous neuroprotective trials, meaning substances given to try to slow progression of the disease. And those, there's been a couple hundred at least done over the years, and they've all failed. And there's many reasons for that, but one reason could be that we're diagnosing it too late in the course. So we're trying to find earlier markers, and one of which there's been a lot of attention to the REM behavior disorders being a marker. for that. So there are clinical trials going on that are following people with that to see. And there's a variety of things that fall under a Parkinson's umbrella, in a sense. There's idiopathic or garden variety Parkinson's, and then there's these other conditions that can occur. And so all of those are being closely studied to see if then we could do a clinical trial when the REM behavior disorder is diagnosed. You know, are there substances at that point that we could give to slow down progression?
And I bet that's some of the work that's going on with your program. Maybe tell us about the movement disorders and Parkinson's program at UW.
Right. So it consists of, so it's part of the Department of Neurology, and the movement disorders group currently has six physicians and one physician's assistant. And then also, though, throughout UW, as really part of the program, we work closely with neurosurgery, with Dr. Wendell Lake in the deep brain stimulation program. Also across campus, we have specialized physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, all that we work with that have a special focused interest in Parkinson's disease. And then really, although they're not always part of our department, but there's scientists on campus, too, doing a lot of very exciting research in the basic science, as well as trying to find treatments for Parkinson's disease as well.
Maya in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Maya. Maya, are you there?
Movement disorders, and specifically tardive dyskinesia, which is a side effect of antipsychotics. And I'm just interested if there's research being done on something that's very commonly given to people that have either psychosis or schizophrenia. It's kind of one of the number one reasons why people go off their medication. And I'm just wondering if there's any crossover or conversations about helping out that demographic of people.
Yes, in our movement disorders program, we do see people with tardive dyskinesia. They're usually referred by psychiatry. The psychiatrist, of course, will usually recognize this. And then if they need help managing it, or confirming a diagnosis or ruling out a different movement disorder, they'll refer those patients to us. Currently, with our clinical trials in neurology movement disorders program, we don't have any clinical trials at this particular time related to tardive dyskinesia, and I'm uncertain if there are any in the UW psychiatry department going on at this time. But we do work closely with them, and you know, there's a lot of even informal consults and that sort of thing because of the different ways that we can try to help manage that with people. So far, there's several theories about why that develops when people are exposed to certain medications, usually antipsychotics, or dopamine blocking agents. And it's very interesting. And in the past five years or so, there have been some medications that have become available that have been very useful to help people manage those symptoms.
Mm. Are there, I'm wondering, what are some of those medications, maybe, perhaps?
Yeah. Valbenazine is one, deutetrabenazine, and these are dopamine. They tend to block certain neurotransmitters, is I guess the best way to put it, and they inhibit production of some of the neurotransmitters and works at the connections between the brain cells that we believe are modified by long-term use and sometimes even short-term exposure to some of the psychiatric medications.
Mm. Maya, does that help out?
That helps out a lot. And I would just say as a test case of one, I have a family member that was diagnosed with psychosis and schizophrenia. And they reported to me that they can feel that coming on. So it's really interesting how it gets put in psychiatry, but they are put on a lot of medications when they're trying to control the psychosis. And the issue, I think, for a lot of folks is trying to decrease it to the least level. And so I just think it's something to look into, because I think sometimes these different body disabilities have some commonalities. Yeah. So I hope that they continue to find some research for it.
Maya, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And speaking of emails, Louise sent us one. Are there definitive tests for movement disorders, or is it a matter of clinical observations and deduction? And can you get movement disorders from mold exposure?
All right. So currently, the best way to diagnose movement disorders is through clinical exam and the clinical expertise of the physician. So that's why people who are movement disorder specialists or neurologists who have had additional training in this area so that we can recognize it. In the Parkinson's realm, there are no definitive tests, but there is development of some testing to support a diagnosis, although those tests at this point are a bit controversial, and different clinicians will use them in a variety of ways. For other, it depends on what the disorder is. For Huntington's disease, there is a gene test for that. The interpretation of that test result is very important. But the majority of things, I would think, that I'm diagnosing, it's really based on the clinical history and my neurologic exam and observation of the abnormal movements.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells will give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Thank you, Larry. I would just like to ask if Lewy body dementia is a type of Parkinson's disease, or is it a separate disease altogether?
Yeah, that's going to undergo evolution over time. Currently, it's on a spectrum of Parkinson's disease. The pathology of dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body disease, if you look at the basic science level of it, it's both diseases are caused or have a marker of an abnormally folded protein called alpha-synuclein in the majority of cases. And the defining factor between the two sometimes gets blurred. It is more like one of the atypical forms of Parkinson's is what I would consider it in my view of practice. However, if you met someone who sees people mainly with dementia, they would view it as maybe a different type of dementia. So we're learning more and more about it and how to distinguish it. But, you know, idiopathic Parkinson's or garden variety Parkinson's starts in certain ways. And then sometimes early in the course of the disease, we'll see the onset of significant cognitive difficulties and some other things. And then from another aspect, people will have significant cognitive difficulties and within the first year or two may develop some other signs of tremor or usually rigidity and slowness of movement, stiffness and slowness that will clue us in. So that's a very wishy-washy answer, but it's one of those things where we're continuing to study it. And the definition, for example, for a strict definition for qualifying for a clinical trial keeps changing.
All right. There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, our guest today, neurologist and director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. Questions for Dr. Bouillon Dent. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Dr. Laura Bouillon Dent from the University of Wisconsin Health Program, the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program. Let me give you the right title here at UW Health, our guest today. And we have many callers online. Just to let you know, at noon today, we'll be talking about shingles, and our guest will be talking about why getting the vaccine is the best way to prevent an infection. Right now, we go to Rick in Eau Claire. Rick, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to mention that I've had Parkinson's for about 12 years, and looking back, I can see aspects of the Parkinson's that I didn't pay much attention to because I seemed part of getting older. And then about 2 years ago, my dyskinesia had become very difficult to cope with. I had constant head movement. Ended up hitting myself sometimes or others because my left arm would just suddenly go all Nazi on me and not follow any rules. But I had DBS surgery just about 2 years ago. And although it certainly didn't cure my Parkinson's and all aspects of it, it took away the tardive dyskinesia in an amazing way. And that it sounds so serious to go through the surgery, but it wasn't. A well-crafted team out of Rochester implemented, I refer to them as my nails in my head, and it was an amazing turnaround for me.
Rick, thanks for calling. Well, talk about this DBS treatment that he was talking about.
Right. DBS has been a remarkable treatment. So in the course of the history of Parkinson's and treatment, the one medicine called Sinemet or Levodopa was a revolutionary treatment that changed many people's lives. And in my opinion, DBS is now a second revolutionary treatment. And we do a lot of this at UW Health. We have an excellent functional neurosurgeon, Dr. Wendell Lake, and his team. For any surgery like this, it's an elective surgery, and patient selection is key. And so our team is really good and experienced at selecting people who will benefit from it because, as this gentleman said, it doesn't cure the disease, but it can markedly improve people's quality of life. And then on the other hand, it is brain surgery. So it's, you know, although the surgeons are quite good at doing it and everything, it's not without some risk. However, it is really remarkable. It's almost you can think of it as a pacemaker for the brain, so to speak, where wire is implanted in your brain, and then you have a battery under your skin in your chest, which is really a computer, and we can manipulate that to create an electrical field in the brain that can help alleviate certain symptoms. And we do it a lot in Parkinson's. We also do it in essential tremor and some other movement disorders as well.
But it's one that you have to pay for out of your own pocket.
No, it is FDA approved, which means Medicare and then other insurances will pay for it. So it's actually part of, in a way, it's now on the list of very classic things that tertiary care centers will offer that have a good Parkinson's and other movement disorder program.
Excellent. Rick, thanks again. Shelley in Two Rivers, thank you for calling.
Hi. What's
on your mind?
Thank you so much for having me on. My husband was diagnosed with Parkinson's in, I think, about 2011, but it took them 6 years to diagnose him and a lot of money out of our pocket. And I am just wondering why, when doctors are suspecting Parkinson's, they can't just give that patient Parkadova Levodopa and see if it helps.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm sorry that it took so long for you and your husband to get an answer. And it's really difficult to know. People, sometimes it's very obvious. They'll have very classic symptoms. Sometimes they won't. I can't speak to what these other doctors did. Often we do use carbidopa levodopa as maybe a test in certain situations. So, yeah. I'm glad that you finally got a diagnosis, and I hope you're connected into some good neurologists taking care of you.
And if that was, if I'm not mistaken, 10, 15 years ago, things have probably changed a bit.
You're right. We've gotten better at recognizing it. We do often recognize it a little earlier in the course of disease. Sometimes, though, it isn't quite as straightforward as you would think.
Yeah. At what age, I mean, basically, this seems to occur more often in elderly or older people. I mean, at what age could this strike?
The spectrum is actually quite broad, but the average age of onset is in the middle 60s, so around 65. Mm. However, I've diagnosed people in their late 20s, early 30s. Other people, they might not start to show definite signs of it until they're in their late 80s. As well. So it's a big spectrum, but usually about 65 or so.
Katie in Madison, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I recently got diagnosed by my primary physician with intention tremor, mm-hmm. and he didn't seem concerned about it at all. It's kind of interfering with some of my everyday activities. And I'm wondering, is this something that I can go to, or I should go to a neurologist for, or
yes.
should I just learn to live with it?
If it's interfering with your activities, you know, like writing, eating, keyboarding, I would recommend that some primary care doctors are comfortable starting some treatment, but if you're in a situation where you feel that's not the case, certainly seeing a neurologist would be very reasonable.
And intentional tremor, what would you talk about what that is?
Yeah, that's usually a different terminology, but it's something called essential tremor. So it's shaking of the hands when you're using your hands, which is different than from a Parkinson's tremor, for example, where the shaking may occur when the limb is at rest. So in essential tremor, the tremors can be very mild and people accommodate to them, but then they can, in some people they will progress and become increasingly actually disabling because it limits the use of the hands, you know, like spilling when you're eating or that sort of thing. Can't do fine motor types of things.
Katie, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Janesville, your turn. Hi, John.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Larry. I just wanted you to touch on I've got a brother and sister that have Parkinson's, a cousin that had it, an uncle. So there must be the genetic connection here, I would assume, because that's a pretty small population that would have that many people. And then is there something that maybe at some point, maybe we would have an indicator that this might be something that as you get older, you may be at risk for?
Right. So the fact that it's in your family puts you already at risk, just like if, you know, you had family members with heart disease or certain forms of cancer. So you have a definite risk factor for Parkinson's disease. There have been some genes associated with it. And the question always comes up, well, should I undergo some genetic testing? And that's very that's person dependent. There's various views. For example, some of the genes, it's not definitive that you would develop signs of Parkinson's. However, they've been associated with it. And would you want that information or not? That's what you always need to think of for any type of genetic testing. What would that information do for you or family members? And I always recommend some genetic counseling. Currently, we don't screen the population for any of these genes because we don't have a treatment. And so, you know, depending on how someone wants to use that information, it may be helpful. Sometimes it may be detrimental. What I usually tell people in my practice when, you know, there are more than one family member with Parkinson's, which is very common, actually, that really taking good care of yourself, you know, meaning, you know, try to get some regular exercise, get good sleep, you know, watch what you eat, all those lifestyle things can actually make a difference. The only potential neuroprotective treatment we have now, meaning slowing down disease progression, is actually exercise. And there's lots of ways exercise can benefit us, but there seems to be something about the exercise that is helpful specifically in Parkinson's disease. So
probably helpful in a lot of ways.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
John, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And by exercise, it could be a variety. I mean, just getting out and walking.
Right. And there are some, you know, for people who are diagnosed, there's lots of very wonderful exercise programs specific to or for people living with Parkinson's disease. And those can be very beneficial. It's also a support network, too, which is also beneficial. There'll be different fads in the type of exercise. For a while, it was bicycling and still, bicycling is good. Currently, there's rock steady boxing has been very popular and helpful for people where they do a little boxing, but also a whole bunch of other exercises and things in the program. So there isn't, you know, really one particular exercise. You have to look at the individual and see how the Parkinson's is affecting them and see, first of all, what they could do safely, but also what types of exercise would be helpful. And that's where our physical therapists are really awesome at helping guide people.
We have Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum on the show once a month. So maybe we'll take that up as a topic for one of the programs. I think that would be
wonderful.
I think it'd be really good. Carol in Fitchburg, we'll talk to you. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Larry. Hello, and thank you to your guests.
Absolutely. What's on your mind?
I really appreciate this program, though what I wanted to ask about was anything having to do with research on post-stroke neurological issues. I can give you the situation in that we've been dealing with. 14 years ago, my husband had a stroke, a rare stroke called a Wallenberg, which he recovered from maybe 90%, 95%. And we thought we were free and clear. And then 3 years ago, he started to have neurological symptoms, rather extreme ones, which finally this year were diagnosed as a susceptibility to neurological problems of what looked like sudden onset dementia and inability to walk. Is this sounding like anything you've heard before?
Yes.
She's nodding yes as you were talking,
yes,
Carol.
Yeah. And I'm sorry that you and your husband are dealing with this. There is a lot of research going on in stroke rehab. Oftentimes that comes under the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehab, looking at these long-term effects of stroke. But that is, unfortunately, people who have had one stroke could be prone to others or just different neurologic conditions that can be very devastating. Across the country, across the world, there's a lot of research going on into those kinds of things.
And where would you go for information on that? I mean, what would be for Carol or anybody else?
I would look to the, actually, sometimes the American Heart Association has stroke-related and post-stroke things.
Yeah, hadn't thought of
you
that.
You know, different, you know, the American Academy of Neurology has some excellent patient or people living with a condition oriented materials that are very supportive too. There's a publication called the Brain Life magazine that is available to people through the American Academy of Neurology.
Carol, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. The number to call, I'll get you on pretty quickly, open lines. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. And we've got some emails here we should probably get through, too. Summer emailed us. She has an older sister who has been diagnosed with spinal ataxia 6. Is it related to Parkinson's?
It is not. The mechanism of the spinocerebellar ataxia, sometimes called SCAs or SCAs, has a different biologic mechanism, although a lot of times the different movement disorders clinically or what you see in the people experience that are living with them can have some similarities.
Virginia emailed us. Virginia's father just passed away with Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's. Oh, she's wondering what's the likelihood she or her brother, this was her father, so would she or her brother be possibly have develop it?
Yeah, that's very hard to know, as we don't have any there's genetic information being collected, but so far a gene hasn't been identified, as far as I know, for dementia with Lewy bodies or Lewy body dementia. Because he had one of these neurodegenerative conditions, there is a slightly increased risk of you have a risk factor now, just as if you had heart disease or something like that. It acts like a risk factor. So there's not like a 50-50 chance or something like that. They are at some increased risk.
Mark wondered about essential tremor and treatments, options for essential tremor.
Right. Essential tremor is that other tremor that occurs when people are using their hands, and there's medications available. There's some assistive devices. Often this affects people's ability to eat, so there's some specialized eating utensils that can be used. And when it's super severe, people can undergo deep brain stimulation surgery, which can be fairly effective.
Jean in Merrill has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As you speak of research yet to be done, now that we're making leaps and bounds in neurology, I have a particular movement disorder that doesn't, I think, have a comprehensive name for what's going on, in that diagnosed with herpes in my 30s, and then herpes became a huge collection of many different subdivisions of herpes, which then gets thrown into shingles now that I'm 70. What is the connection, neurologically speaking, from that brain-based signal to my actual limbs? In that whenever I'm undergoing a shingles herpes attack, I feel it shooting neurologically through my lower pelvis down through my legs, and it makes every difference in the world as to whether I can get up, get down, do my horseback riding at the age of 70. I'm very aware of all that. And then I remember my grandparents speaking of this catch-all phrase called sciatica.
Yep. So sciatica is a very specific disorder caused by a pinching of the nerve, so to speak, a specific nerve that comes from the low back down into the legs. The connection that a lot of people will have things that we don't have a definitive explanation for, but the virus that causes shingles and all that stuff does remain in the nerves. And so some people, that's why they'll get an attack of shingles, is because the nerve and the virus gets reactivated. And you'll hear more about that with the next guest, the shingles expert, yeah, that will be talking about that. But because it affects the nerves and nervous system, people can have tons of different symptoms that will affect them.
Laura was wondering, has an autoimmune disease, Behçet's disease, a fairly rare disease, mm-hmm, in this country, but wondering if that could be a precursor to a movement disorder like...
Yeah, not usually.
Diane in Portage, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I would like to ask, and I'm sorry, I missed the very first part of your program, and I hear that you were discussing REM disorders and Parkinson's. I have a friend who's experiencing Parkinson's, and she's having terrible problems with nightmares and trying to get sustained sleep and true rest and things. Is this more a matter of medication side effects, or is it the Parkinson's?
Oh, it could be either or both. People that live with Parkinson's will develop sleep disorders to varying degrees. They can have sleep fragmentation, so they can fall asleep, but they can only stay asleep for a few hours. Some people, if they reach that deep level of sleep, our REM sleep, they'll have dream enactment. So mechanisms that usually paralyze us during our sleep are not functioning properly in people with Parkinson's, and so they're able to act out those dreams. And sometimes for some people, the medicines will worsen that if she's on things like carbidopa, levodopa, or various dopamine agonists. And like everything in Parkinson's and even neurology, it's quite variable, and people will respond differently. But that is certainly something that she can speak to her physicians about to help manage. Obviously, she'll feel a whole lot better. She can sleep a little bit better.
Yeah, for sure. I was thinking back as you were talking. It's been years and years since I had one of those episodes where you wake up and you can't move. It's a scary thing.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
it is indeed. Diane, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, and we have open lines to get you on pretty quickly here, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Tomorrow on the show, we have some of our favorite outdoor writers back, and the three of them will be talking about current issues in nature and wildlife, and you'll be able to join in with your questions. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, who is a neurologist, director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. Questions, comments, experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Bob in Monroe next. Bob, thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. So my question is, what is the expected course, or if there is a treatment for benign paroxysmal positional vertigo?
That's really variable. That's part of the a special part of the brain called the vestibular system, part of the brain that helps with the ears too. And people will have it to varying degrees. The most useful thing that I've found when people are experiencing that is to see a specialized physical therapist that can do some vestibular rehab with people, and they can teach people that live with this some techniques, because it's the sort of thing that will tend to flare, and then it gets a little bit better and then flares. You know, it's a up and down type of thing.
So you'd probably want somebody with that specific kind of training.
Right, right.
Be calling around a little bit, perhaps. I'm sure there are some at UW.
Right, correct. Usually it's a physical therapist that will specialize in neurorehabilitation versus like orthopedic rehabilitation. And they will have specialized training and can do vestibular rehabilitation.
There you go, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Jonah in Eau Claire next. Jonah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Howdy.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, I'm calling to inquire about like the precursor conditions for Parkinson's, if there are any, or any like very early onset symptoms. As someone in my youth with family with a lot of neurodegenerative disorders, like how early can you tell, and through what avenues?
Right. That's a real tough one. Usually, some people will have something called REM behavior disorder, a dream reenactment. Some people will have a variety of symptoms. However, at the time, they might not be aware, but once the disease progresses, they will look back and say, oh, I wonder, you know, if in retrospect, oh, my bad constipation was maybe the very first sign. So, you know, it's hard because you feel like you're living in this state where you're monitoring, right, to see, oh, my gosh, am I going to get that? And that's not a fun place to live, but I usually suggest to people and family members that they just try to stay active, they be aware. If they are worried, you know, they can request to see a neurologist or a movement disorder specialist if that's helpful. Currently, there isn't any medication or anything to take, you know, to slow or, you know, prevent the onset. Those things are in development. Sometimes participating in a clinical trial is helpful for people. The Michael J. Fox Foundation has a trial where they're collecting lots of different data for a big worldwide database, and that can be accessed online through the Michael J. Fox Foundation. It's the PPMI, Progressive Parkinson's Marker Initiative, I believe is what the initials stand for. So doing things like that sometimes help people when they're in this state of worry and anxiety about if they're going to develop something or not.
You know, I'm going to go back to exercise for a minute. I was thinking about, I get up every morning early and do a few miles in the morning before, and nothing all that strenuous, but I think you feel better.
Right. Right.
After you're, or while you're doing it, and yeah, and after.
Yeah. And so there's lots of good reasons to exercise. And if you're worried about a neurodegenerative disease, that's good. There's in the Parkinson's field, there actually has been basic science studies using different animal models that have force the animals to exercise. And when they look at the brain, it does seem to even have some sort of brain response. So it's not just, you know, developing stamina so your body can be more resilient to handle the effects of the disease, but there might be release of neurotrophic factors that help the brain cells survive and stay healthy. So there is some evidence even for that, that I tell myself when I'm trying to get moving.
Jonah, get moving. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Lori in Rockton, Illinois. We'll go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Well, hello, everyone. I am calling just kind of as a point of interest for your listeners. I have a very, very good friend who is at the tail end of PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, which is a really, really horrible disease. It's rare, but yet it seems like it's on the rise. And I don't know if that's because my ears are attuned to it now. Very difficult to diagnose. It's kind of a process of elimination. But it is out there, and many, many people have no idea how to treat it, whether they're caregivers or speech pathologists, OT, PT. It's a very, very difficult, horrible disease.
Progressive supranuclear palsy.
Right. Progressive supranuclear palsy. That is something that a movement disorder specialist is good at diagnosing. I mean, good in, you know, parentheses, at diagnosing. It is considered one of the atypical forms of Parkinson's. And it's one of the things that a good movement disorders neurologist will be screening for all the time. You know, when they've diagnosed Parkinson's, they usually will be looking for signs of that. And you're right that it's a horrible disease. Not that any of these things are good diseases. People will feel isolated, and oftentimes I've had my patients that I've diagnosed with this condition benefit actually from some of the Parkinson's Foundation and the Parkinson's patient sites will give at least some support. We throw them under that umbrella. Because especially at end stages, things can be somewhat similar. But yes, your friend was lucky that you were there to support her, or is lucky, Lori, that your support is there.
Yes, and thank you very much for calling. Kelly in Mill Bluff, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've recently had some testing done. I had a scan as well as MRI, which both were showed to be normal, but I have a mixed tremor, resting postural and action tremor, and have had muscle weakness, especially difficulty with walking.
Okay.
And we've trialed carbidopa levodopa for a bit, and that helped me so much. Like, I can get moving again.
Okay.
With that medication, but like the DAS scan looked normal.
Right.
So are there any other conditions for which carbidopa levodopa would be effective?
There can be, but the thing to know about the DAT scan is that there's a lot of false negatives that can occur with it. So depending on how that's used, just, you know, any test has a certain degree of false positives and false negatives. None of them have 100% specificity and sensitivity, as we say. And so I have many patients who have mixed tremors and this sort of thing, and are developing Parkinson's, and their DAT scan might be negative. So DAT scans can miss Parkinson's disease, unfortunately. I can't say that you have that, you know, because I haven't been able to meet you and examine you, but you might want to see someone who is specialized in movement disorders. They'd be able to handle that quite well and give you appropriate medications and not get you over-medicated, all that good stuff.
Someone else is wondering in an email if anyone has done research on hypnosis to treat central tremors.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if there's any formal studies of that. I've certainly had my patients with essential tremor talk about that. And I know that there's been people who are good at meditation that will find that that helps reduce their tremors, especially in anxiety-provoking things. But I don't know if there's been any. I imagine there's been some formal hypnosis studies, but I'm not familiar with those. I think anything that helps people calm down to some degree will help with their tremors, no matter what the cause, because if we're even normal anxiety of going to work or social, you know, fun anxiety, our adrenaline is going, and that will often make the tremors a little bit worse than usual, even if you're not anxious per se. But any of those conditions, just like after exercise, people who live with tremors are usually quite shaky as well. So.
And on that note, Dr. Laura, thank you so much for being with us. You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
Oh, I hope so. If you'll have me back, I'll be here.
Oh, we
will. Thank you for this opportunity.
Dr. Laura Bouillon-Dent, neurologist and director of the Movement Disorders and Parkinson's Program at UW Health. It was great to have her with us. And thank you so much for listening. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about shingles and shingles treatments. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. It's a health day, and for the next hour, we'll be talking with you about shingles and how you can avoid this painful infection or how to deal with it if you've had it or have it. Our guest, Dr. Laura Feli, is an infectious disease physician. She's at Amplify Health in La Crosse. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about your experience with shingles, maybe what helped you find relief. Questions about it, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Laura Feli, welcome to the show.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start out with a definition, perhaps. What exactly is shingles and what causes it?
Yeah. So shingles is caused by the virus that causes chickenpox. So typically what happens for adults born before 1980, and that 99% of people will have had chickenpox at some point in their life. The thing to know about the virus, the herpes zoster virus, varicella zoster virus, or VZV as we call it, it's a herpes virus. So it's the same sort of group of viruses like cold sores. So once you have chickenpox, similar to cold sore, they kind of the virus sort of goes throughout your body and takes root in your nerves. And there it can lie dormant for many, many years, for decades, until something changes in your immune system and the virus wakes back up. And when the virus wakes back up, it travels down along the nerve root to the skin, and that's where it causes that really characteristic painful rash.
Yeah, and I haven't had it myself, thankfully. I had the vaccinations for it, but I have friends who have had it, and it's miserable. You're an infectious disease physician. What does your day-to-day job look like?
Oh, yeah, my day-to-day job, it kind of varies. Some weeks I see mostly outpatients, and those are people who come to me with clinical concerns like HIV, or sort of mysteries like recurrent respiratory infections or hospital follow-ups. And then some weeks I'm in the hospital, and in the hospital, teams ask me specific questions about infectious diseases, so like post-surgical infections or management of a patient with a complicated pneumonia. What I love about infectious disease is the variety of things that I see. So it always keeps you on your toes, and it's always very exciting.
It sounds like it. What's been your experience with treating shingles in your role at Amplify?
Oh, yeah. So honestly, by the time most primary care providers are really familiar with uncomplicated shingles, so I don't actually see a lot of that. I mostly see complicated shingles infections, which are a small fraction of shingles cases, but they can get very serious and pretty devastating. So, for example, the thing I see, the form of complicated zoster I see the most is probably the neurologic manifestations. So if you think about the shingles virus living in the nerve, most of the time it sort of extends outward to the skin, but sometimes it can also travel backwards and affect the central nervous system. And then you see things like meningitis or encephalitis. People coming in, often they had sort of the characteristic rash. They didn't think much of it. Then they started acting different. Their family noticed they were confused. They were spiking high fevers. Then they come in. They get a lumbar puncture, and we find evidence of the shingles virus in their cerebrospinal fluid. So that's very serious, and that requires treatment with intravenous antivirals. And that's frequently the type of patients I see.
Cindy in Park Falls has a question for you, so let's go there. Cindy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Usually we get a vaccine to avoid getting a disease like the flu. How does the shingles vaccine work if you already have the virus?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. So basically what the vaccine does is that it bolsters your immune response to the varicella zoster virus, or VZV, the shingles virus. I'm kind of using those all interchangeably. So shingles becomes much more prevalent as we get older, much more common. And the reason for that seems to be that we lose our immunity to the initial chickenpox infection we got when we were kids. So basically, it's recommended that people get the Shingrix vaccine after 50 if they have a normal immune system, earlier if they have problems with their immune system, to sort of bolster that immunity and prevent the virus from waking back up and causing this rash.
I'm wondering, I had two shots for it, just to go along with what Cindy was talking about there. And why do you need a second dose?
It's basically to just sort of provide a boost. So the first wakes your immune system back up. The second really reinforces it. To be honest with you, I'm not really I don't know much more than that. I'm not really a vaccine expert, but we do know that that second dose is really important, and it's good to get it within 2 to 6 months of that first shot.
Yeah, I think I went a little touch longer than that, but
that's all right.
And as I recall, I had a little discomfort, but it wasn't bad.
Tolerate it pretty well from what I've heard. There's sometimes you can get some local irritation or inflammation, you know, your arm hurts, you don't want to move it. Sometimes like 10%, I was seeing up to 10% of people might have sort of more systemic symptoms, just feeling unwell or kind of icky. And that typically goes away in 1 to 3 days. So it's a short time that you'll be feeling gross. And when you think about shingles, one of the real complications is this thing called post-herpetic neuralgia, which is pain that can last upwards of 90 days after a shingles infection. So I view it as just a very small investment of your time overall to prevent some real misery later on.
Yeah, and it gave me a good excuse for a not-so-good round of golf because my arm was sore.
That'll do it.
Martha in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Martha.
Thank you for this. You know, for me, what happened was I woke up on a Friday with a headache like I had an axe buried in my forehead. And the problem was I didn't have a rash I could see. So I went to the emergency room after taking, you know, every headache thing and all day long, and I couldn't. And they gave me something for the headache. There was no rash I was aware of, so I went home, went back Saturday, same thing. As soon as the headache medicine wore off, I literally thought I had a bullet in my brain. And then it took 3 trips to the emergency room. On the third day, they called in the head of the emergency department, because it was on a weekend. He walked in, and I said, you know, I have this little rash on my hairline by my scalp that kind of hurts. And none of the doctors could figure it out. This is in Menominee at Mayo Clinic. And the head of the emergency room walked in, looked at my rash, looked at my chart, said, yep, it's shingles, turned around and walked out. And then the
oh my
treated me. But, you know, it was a weekend crew, you know, the younger staff. And sure. I didn't have a rash I could show them, so it wasn't their fault.
That's a thing we do see, is that sort of prodromal pain, the pain in the skin that, like, I think it up to 72 hours before the rash appears, you can see that pain. So Yeah, if you've never had shingles before and you've never experienced it, it can be really upsetting and really hard to diagnose. So I'm glad they were able to get to the bottom of that eventually. My goodness.
Thanks, Martha, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, once you have it, are you stuck with it?
Well, there are things you can do to try to shorten the duration. So really, if you start noticing pain in one sort of strip, because the typical shingles rash occurs in strips throughout your body called dermatomes, and that's the area of skin, you know, innervated by a single nerve. So if you start noticing pain or you start noticing the beginning of a rash that's quite painful, the best thing you can do is get to a doctor as soon as possible, because if you're able to start oral antivirals within 72 hours, that can decrease how long you got the rash for, and it can also potentially help with the pain. So being vigilant and not being shy about talking to your doctor if things just aren't feeling right is really the way to go, I think.
Dana emailed us. She has Guillain-Barré syndrome, or had it as a child, and now she's told she's unable to take flu shots or shingles vaccine.
Yeah.
And she's wondering, will any drug company make these shots in a more acceptable medium for someone like me?
God, I would. That's a great question, and I would love that, because that is one of the contraindications for the shingle shot is a history of Guillain-Barré. I think that's an area where, like, you should probably talk to your doctor about it. It's not an absolute contraindication, but I'm certainly not saying that if you have Guillain-Barré, you should go out and get vaccinated. Like, it's a very tough question. And, yeah, I think really what we need is just more research and, you know, newer and better vaccines.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's a tough one for sure.
Sandy emailed. She's 60 years old this year. Pretty sure she didn't have chicken pox when she was a kid. Asked two doctors if she should get the shingles vaccine since she doesn't think she had chicken pox. One doctor didn't know and said, that's a good question. The other went online and said it should be okay. Sandy Googled it and the site said no.
Oh, geez, that's so confusing.
She does have HSV-1. Should she get the chicken pox vaccine? Should she get the shingles vaccine? She has a couple autoimmune disorders and vestibular hypofunction, so she has balance and visual disturbances, so she's leery of potential side effects.
Yeah, that is a really complicated situation. As I think I mentioned at the beginning, you know, even if you're not just because there was so much chickenpox when we were growing up, you know, or before 1980, you know, that there is about a 99% chance that at some point in your life you were exposed to chickenpox and you did have it. Some places will say you can check serology, so basically checking to see if you have an antibody response. But the problem is, as we get older, that antibody response diminishes, so that test might not be reliable either, you know. I guess from my perspective, when people are in that age group, I do recommend that they get the vaccine. I think that it's very low risk and potentially very high reward, just given how miserable shingles is. You know, it sounds like she's got a lot medically going on, so I commend her for talking to her doctors and getting different opinions, you know, and obviously I can't give her specific medical advice without knowing her, but I think for most cases, you know, even if people aren't sure that they had a history of chickenpox, if they're over the age of 50, it's a good idea to get the shingle shot.
Carol in Crandon has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi. My question is this. I'm 82 years old, and a long time ago, I got the one dose shingle vaccine. And then recently, and I just had, you know, normal sore arms and tiredness, I decided to increase my coverage for shingles, and I got my first of the two vaccinations on October 6th of 2023. I had the usual sore arms and tiredness. That went away. My concern was I had an extremely sore throat for about 5 or 6 days. I've been, and that did go away, but I've never had that with the vaccination before. I'm hesitant to get the second dosage.
I'd like some advice on that. And it's been about 2 years, 2023, or a year and a half at least. What do you think, Dr. Feli?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting one because, you know, certainly people can get all sorts of symptoms post-vaccine. Sore throat is not typically one that we see, and certainly not one lasting for 5 to 6 days. So there's a part of me that wonders, like, could you have just gotten unlucky and gotten, like, an upper respiratory infection that sort of presented at that time? I think it would be fine for you to get the second shot, just because even if it was related to the vaccine, typically post-vaccine symptoms are much less severe with the booster shot. So I think it would be safe. I do understand your concern, but I think you're going to tolerate it okay.
Dr. Laura Feli is an infectious disease physician at Amplify Health in La Crosse. Great to have her with us. And you can join in, too. Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thursday, April 17th, I hope you'll join us from 11 to noon for our next virtual book club meeting. We're talking with Wisconsin author Kevin Kleisner about his latest novel. It's titled A Killer's Terms, a thriller about an FBI agent who's tracking down the person who tried to murder his girlfriend. Story is set in Milwaukee, and there's still time to read it. And I hope you can join us. Again, that's Thursday, April 17th on WPR News. Right now, we're talking about shingles with Dr. Laura Feli, an infectious disease physician at Amplify Health in La Crosse. And number of callers online. Let's go to Deborah in Middleton next. Deborah, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. When the first round of COVID shots came out, I was trying to be the first one in line. And I got the vaccine. And then during the course of the next 2 weeks, I had headaches. I had a rash on my face. And I thought I'd been bitten by a spider. Yeah, right. So I finally went into urgent care because I really was in a lot of pain on my face and head. And the doctor walked in and said, shingles, and walked back out. And it was too late for me to get the antiviral because I'd already toughed it out so long. But I did have to go and see an optometrist to make sure there weren't any lesions on my eyes. And I went, and he asked me if I'd had the COVID shot within the last 2 weeks. And I said, yes, I had. And he said, you're the fourth person I've seen this morning with shingles on your face. So my question is has there been some kind of substantiation to the fact that and I'm not suggesting anyone not get the COVID vaccine, get the COVID vaccine, but is there any kind of connection or has there been any kind of valid connection made between the shingles and the COVID vaccination? Thank you.
That's a really excellent question. I fully support the COVID shot. Totally agree. To my knowledge, there's not any specific connection between shingles and COVID vaccine specifically. What I will say is that it's known that any kind of perturbations or stress or anything sort of that has the potential to shake up your immune system a little bit can trigger an outbreak. So, you know, the COVID vaccine, you know, that it's triggering an immune response, you know, could that potentially have woken up the VZV virus, you know, potentially, you know. So I'm sorry you got in too late to get the antiviral. That's a very common story where people just kind of tough it out. But yeah, it's not uncommon.
Dale in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hi, Larry. I really enjoy your shows when I get a chance to listen in, and this one in particular. I managed to acquire a really severe case of shingles in July of 2013. A really bad rash, mid-torso from spine to sternum. And it lasted for months. And in my case, I'm one of the lucky few, apparently, that a pain never has gone away.
Oh,
yeah.
So that's known as postherpetic neuralgia, and pretty much nothing to be done for it.
That's a really tough situation. Yeah, 10 to 15% of people get postherpetic neuralgia, and it is this constant severe nerve pain. And, you know, unfortunately, you are right. To my knowledge, there's really not any, you know, proven treatment for it. You know, there's certainly things people will try. You know, some people will try gabapentin. I've heard of steroids being tried. I've heard of tricyclic antidepressants being tried, just really anything to try to modulate that nerve response. But unfortunately, there's just really nothing that seems good for it right now. I'm so sorry you've had that experience.
Yeah. I'm wondering, we were in the last hour, we were talking, physical therapy came up in the last hour. And I wonder if there'd be any reason why a physical therapist couldn't be helpful in maybe training the muscles to work in a little bit different way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly never against physical therapy. I think it's excellent, and I feel like it's underutilized. The problem with postherpetic pain is it's not really the muscles per se. It's residual sort of dysregulation from the nerve that was infected. So, you know, it's strengthening the muscle. You know, certainly that might help. You know, if you're compensating abnormally, you know, and muscle pain is just going to make that worse. But yeah, it's a really tough scenario.
Dale, good luck, and thank you for calling. Brad in Stoughton, on to you now. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Doc. I currently have shingles on the right side of my head. I'm on about day 19, though. So, I mean, typical, had light headache, toughed it out on a Tuesday, finally went in on a Friday after I'd broken out. They gave me antiviral starting on that Friday, and then went through the whole deal with the sores and the finally it getting. But I have a residual. I mean, it's still sort of the touch on the right side of my head. Tylenol knocks it back. Yes, lesions are gone. But it's still sort of the touch, and I still get that headache.
Yeah, that sounds, again, sort of like that residual nerve pain, you know. And hopefully yours is it. Would you say overall it's sort of getting better since when it was at its peak, or is it just sort of persisting?
Yes. No, it's better. It's better. Good. It's not as intense as it was.
But it's still there.
Yeah, better, but still there. Yeah, that unfortunately, the pain can definitely linger. My hope is that it slowly continues to reside and that trajectory you're on keeps improving. But yeah, it's there's not really a guarantee. That's why, you know, the best treatment for this, unfortunately, really is prevention, because as you've noticed, even if you do get the antivirals, sometimes that pain is still there and still persistent.
Brad, thanks for calling. Stephen in Eau Claire, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, I've seen a lot of people with shingles. My wife, seen patients. I was in practice. And one of the things that I found that helped with the pain afterwards is low-level lasers.
So that's really interesting. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, low-level lasers I found good results with. And not much else.
It's one of those areas where, you know, I'm pretty sure there's no studies about lasers and the efficacy of lasers, but the pain is just so severe and persistent that I say, you know, if you want to try it and it's not causing any harm, I don't see any harm in it.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Wally in Hudson has a question. Hi, Wally.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Interesting subject.
Thank you.
So my question is I've had Bell's palsy twice on each side of my face. Does that have any relationship to that shingles virus?
Interesting. So Bell's palsy, you can... Well, let me ask you, have you had any... of the characteristic rash with it or any of the pain with it, or is it just really the paralysis that you're dealing with?
It was just regularly the paralysis, and it just came on like all of a sudden.
Yeah, so you can definitely see the cranial nerves, and that's what Bell's palsy is a effect of the on the facial nerve. You can definitely see the cranial nerves involved with shingles. But there's a lot of things that cause Bell's palsy. Lyme disease can cause it. Sometimes it's idiopathic, meaning it just sort of happens spontaneously. So if you've not had the rash or any really other characteristic symptoms of shingles, I'm not really sure it's related or not. You know, it could be, but it probably is likely due to something else. But that's an excellent question.
Yeah, thanks, Wally. Appreciate it. Deborah in Madison, your turn. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, good afternoon. I've had shingles in the past, and I'm contemplating getting the vaccine, but I'm wondering if I don't get it and I were to get shingles again, would that outbreak happen in the same spot as before?
Great question. So no guarantees that it would happen in the same spot. It might, but it could also happen, you know, when you get chickenpox, it goes throughout your whole body. So theoretically, any sensory nerve could be infected and could break out in shingles. It's most common on the torso, back, and face, kind of like we're hearing from our callers. But yeah, it's not really like a cold sore where it always pops out in the same place. Shingles can pop out really, unfortunately, any place in your body.
And just to follow up on that, the fact that Deborah's had shingles, still it's worth it to get the shingles vaccine.
It is still worth it. So I would get the Shingrix vaccine. I'd recommend the two doses because, unfortunately, just because you've had it once, you know, doesn't mean you, it can't happen again. Typically, most doctors will recommend if you've had shingles like, you know, a couple months ago, we typically wait for a year to give you the shingles shot just because you do get a little bit of a transient bump in immunity from having that shingles outbreak. So we give it about a year later just to maximize the efficacy of that vaccine. But, yeah, it would still definitely be recommended for her.
Phyllis in Winona, Minnesota, called but couldn't stay with us. She's curious about the new research connection, and we've read a lot about this recently, the shingles vaccine to dementia prevention, that connection.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's so fascinating. Yeah, there was just a study that came out. I'm sure this is what you're referring to, that in Wales, people who got the old formulation of the shingle shot, the Zostavax, were 20% likely to develop dementia over time. And I was looking into that, and apparently, like that effect is we still may be seeing that with the Shingrix, the new formulation, which it might even be a stronger impact on dementia. So I think this is really exciting stuff.
I do as well. It's great. Carol in New Richmond has a question. Carol, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I have a relative that recently recovered from shingles, and now she has just really bad anxiety. The rash is gone and the pain is basically gone, but a lot of anxiety. And I guess the cardiologist told her that that is connected with that. Can you speak to that at all?
That's really interesting. You know, I have to admit to you, I haven't heard of post-shingles anxiety specifically, but there is definitely a connection between, you know, as I mentioned, the nerves are connected to the skin and to the central nervous system. So, you know, this is a little bit of an aside, and I'm sorry, a little bit of a wonky infectious disease things to comment on. But they've done studies that even on people with uncomplicated shingles, if you sample their cerebrospinal fluid, you can find the virus in there. So is it affecting your skin but somehow also having an effect on, like, your central nervous system, your brain, potentially manifesting as anxiety? I don't know, but it's really interesting, and I'm sorry she's dealing with that. That's really,
yeah, it's really, really tough.
You know, shingles outbreak, that's a lot to bear.
It is indeed. Carol, thank you for calling. I'm sorry for that, for those problems. Richard in Oak Creek, your turn. Hi Richard.
There. Hi. My question is concerning shingles. I've heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, that sometimes if you have long-term shingles, it can cause brain fog and also, in the long term, in some intellectual decline. Is there any truth to that?
That's a great question. You know, I'm personally not familiar with that. I do have patients who have subjectively reported that to me. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if that were proven to be the case, but I don't know that there's enough research on that yet. I think that's definitely worth looking into, the long-term, you know, mental effects of having shingles.
Yeah. Richard, thanks for calling. And again, you can join in too. Numbers 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Tony in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I am 36 years old, and I've had shingles three different times. Once when I was 20, once when I was about 24, and once when I was 32. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on having it generally young, and what your thoughts are on me getting the vaccine.
First of all, I'm so sorry you've had that experience. And second of all, you're not alone. I definitely know a number of young people who have had shingles multiple times. I don't quite know why that is, to be honest with you. You know, I sometimes wonder, like, is there a very getting on my wonky infectious disease hat a little bit, I apologize, but they've done studies showing that there are certain, like, very small mutations that render people a little bit more susceptible to the cold sore virus, herpes viruses. For young people who have recurrent shingles outbreaks like that, I do kind of wonder, like, could you have, like, an underlying very small change in your immune system that's triggering this? I would definitely recommend talking to your doctor about getting vaccinated. Like I said, it's for people with normal immune systems, it's over the age of 50, but people with, you know, changes in their immune system, immunocompromise, we vaccinate as soon as 18 or older. So I think it's worth having a conversation with your primary care doc to see, like, could this potentially be interpreted or be due to immunodeficiency? And if that's the case, then, yeah, I would certainly get the shingle shot.
And we had earlier had a question about someone with Behçet's disease, which is an autoimmune, kind of a rare one for our state. But would that, and the person was 21 or 22, would that person be wise to get a shingle shot even at an early age?
I think it's worth talking to the doctor, definitely. Like, people with Behçet, I don't know a ton about Behçet syndrome, but I know that they are frequently treated with steroids and immunomodulatory agents, and those can definitely increase your risk of a shingles outbreak. So even if they're very young, I think it's worth talking about and potentially worth pursuing.
Let's take another call. Nancy in Washburn, thank you for calling.
Yes, I had the shingles shot back in 2009. My question is, should I be getting these next two?
That's a great question. So my guess is that you probably got the old formulation with Zostavax, and that was a live vaccine. It was a little bit less. Its effect tended to wane a little bit over time. And since you got that, you know, a decade or so ago, I think it would probably be worth reaching out to your primary care doc to, you know, talking about getting the new formulation. I think it's very likely to promote, you know, increased immunity to shingles, and I think that the risk of harm is very, very low. So, yeah, I think it's worth looking into.
All right, Nancy. Look into it. Jennifer in Menominee, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Great,
thanks,
appreciate
for taking
the call.
My call.
Sure.
Yeah. I had a stem cell transplant for multiple myeloma in 2020 and had gotten all these, you get all your vaccines, you get revaccinated from, you know, whatever, but I could not get the shingles vaccine or Shingrix because, and I am now currently on acyclovir twice a day. It was 800 milligrams for like the first couple months, and now it's 400 milligrams twice a day. And it's really a big pill, and I don't like taking. Well, anyway, it's just a pill. But is it still prohibited? I know they watch my ANC count a lot, and it's now I am off Revlimid. So my ANC is like 2.2 or something. But, and I've asked my my myeloma doctor. Well, it's been, I've never really asked him if I could get that vaccine.
I would definitely ask him. You know, I'm glad to hear your ANC is popping back up after your stem cell transplant. That's huge. That's excellent. I know this is a little outside my area of expertise, but I know that people who have just received a stem cell transplant are maintained on a wide variety of prophylaxis afterwards, some, like the antiviral that you're on. Sometimes I've seen antifungals before, stuff like that. So I don't really feel comfortable giving you advice about that, but I would definitely bring it up with your hematologist, because this is not a live vaccine. I think that's worth pointing out. It used to be a live vaccine, so people with organ transplants or stem cell transplants, you know, it wasn't recommended for them due to the risk. But this is not a live vaccine. It is safe in those populations. And, yeah, I think it's definitely worth having that conversation with them.
Jennifer, thank you. David in Park Falls, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you doing today? I have a question. I had my shingles, and then I went in, and my doctor gave me the two shots and all that. I'm 69-year-old male. Of course, David, yeah. Have they done any studies at all with, like, gummies, THC, for anxiety? Because doesn't shingles re-flare up with anxiety or
it's some... Yeah, that's a great question. Anecdotally, I have heard people tell me that, you know, their shingles are just precipitated by extreme stress, stressful periods in their life. You know, just again, anecdotally, a lot of my friends got it in medical school and residency, you know, when our exams came due. You know, I don't know if there's any studies that looking at, you know, anything to promote better anxiety control, you know, might have a beneficial effect on shingles, but there's so many factors that go into a shingles outbreak that I can't really say for sure, but I'm definitely a proponent of anxiety management. Though perhaps not with the CBD or the gummies.
Oh, David, thank you. Dr. Laura Feli is an infectious disease physician at Amplify Health in La Crosse. Great to have her with us. You're on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today as we talk infectious diseases, zeroing in on shingles with our guest, Dr. Laura Feli, an infectious disease physician at Amplify Health in La Crosse. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Christina in Glenwood City. We'll go to you now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I've got two quick questions. First, I'm currently 67. I had shingles in the third grade. Am I more susceptible to getting that? And I have had both vaccines. And the other question is my spouse doesn't know whether he had chicken pox, so he doesn't know if you should get the shingles vaccine. What are your thoughts on that?
Great question. So to answer your first question, you know, if you've gotten the shingles shot already, I think your risk is quite low. And regarding your husband's question, 99% of people born before 1980 were exposed to the chickenpox virus just because it was so prevalent back then. So for most patients above that age group or in that age group, we just say just go ahead and get vaccinated, even if you're not sure.
There you go, Christina. Thank you so much for calling. Listener from La Crosse emailed, highly recommend getting the vaccine. 13 years later, they still have occasional symptoms that feel like claws grabbing the inside of their skin from inside their abdomen. In 2012, they just completed 9 months of cancer treatments when the rash and pain at their waistline began. Do shingles occur when the body has undergone surgery and stress to the body?
Absolutely, it does. Any kind of physical stress to the body, whether that be chemotherapy, whether that be surgery, any major insult to your immune system can precipitate a shingles outbreak. So unfortunately, that story that person is sharing is not uncommon. And I'm so sorry to hear they're dealing with symptoms that far down the line.
Saran in Racine, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having my call. I just wanted to say that when I got shingles both times, once in the early 90s when there were no medications, And I have a homeopathic doctor that got me through it. And with the medications that were available with holistic pharmacies. And it's that both times when I got it, they were during high stress times. Even the second time, it was just one particular day that was extreme stress. But also I connected, those were also times when I was highly deficient in nutrition and dehydrated.
Yeah, I mean, anything that puts your body under significant stress, whether that be emotional stress or physical stress, you are running the risk of the shingles virus waking back up. So, yeah, that's a pretty classic story, and I'm sorry you've had it twice. That's unfortunate.
John was wondering, how contagious is shingles?
That's a great question. So, the classic rash of shingles are these sort of blisters that form and then break open. And there is chickenpox virus in that fluid. So if somebody who's never had chickenpox before, like a young kid, a baby, somebody who's severely immunodeficient, comes in contact with that fluid, they can get chickenpox. So generally what we recommend is keeping your rash covered, not letting anybody touch it until the rash crusts over. Typically takes about 7 to 10 days for the rash to crust over. Once it's crusted over, everything is scabbed and there's no blisters, you're not considered infectious.
Barbie mailed us, is it possible to get shingles from receiving a flu shot?
So not directly, but sort of there's nothing in the flu shot that specifically triggers shingles, but it is, you know, sort of any alteration to your immune system. So for a flu shot, you know, you are activating your immune response. You know, you're building your immunity to the flu. It's a little bit of a physical stress, which is why we often feel a little bit achy and not great after a flu shot. Again, a little price to pay for a real huge benefit down the line. I think, again, this could fall into the category of like seemingly minor physical stresses that can precipitate an outbreak. So I would say if you're eligible for it, get a shingle shot too.
Elizabeth emailed us, is it okay for someone who's receiving a biological immunosuppressant like Enbrel or Humira to get the Shingrix vaccinations?
Yes, it absolutely is. So it used to be before 2020, the shingles vaccine we had, the Zostavax, that was a live vaccine, and it was a little bit contraindicated in people who had immunodeficiencies. But this new formulation is not a live vaccine. It's a recombinant vaccine, and that means that it's safe for people who are on the biologics. So, yes, I think that's just fine.
And why does the rash often appear in stripes? The only, and you know, only on the right side, or maybe it's only on the left side of the body.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's because the virus is living in these sensory nerves, and sensory nerves. If you looked at a human without, if you just looked at their nervous system, we almost look like jellyfish. You know, we've got all these nerves extending from our spinal cord out to our skin everywhere. And each sensory nerve basically covers a strip of skin. So when the shingles virus wakes up, it's a spontaneous event in one of those nerves. So the rash is only over that strip of skin that single nerve is affecting or rather innervating. I will say, you know, you had asked me earlier about like what I see as an infectious disease physician. There are cases in which people can get disseminated shingles or disseminated zoster. And in that case, basically, that's somebody who has a very severe immunodeficiency. Their immune system is really, really depressed. The shingles basically can travel anywhere on the skin. It's not limited to that strip, and it can also infect the internal organs. So people can get very severe hepatitis or very severe pneumonia due to VZV or the shingles virus. So that's the most extreme form of this, and that can be fatal even if really aggressively treated. But for most people, it's just limited to that single nerve waking up, and it's just that one strip of skin.
Sarana and Racine called back to say that chamomile tea was of great relief to her shingles blisters. She used it as a topical solution.
I think that's great. I think as long as you're keeping it clean, because that is another problem that you can have sometimes with shingles is bacterial infection of the the rash. So if you start having the shingles outbreak, but then it starts, it doesn't start crusting over, you start noticing a little bit of purulent drainage or the skin starts turning red, that's another time to go to your doctor just to make sure that you don't also have, unfortunately, a bacterial infection, insult to injury. But chamomile tea, that seems pretty low risk. So if that provides you with a little bit of symptomatic benefit, because very little else will, I think that's fine.
Yeah. And this whole business about it being near the eye, if you get a rash near the eye, it'd be hard to avoid touching it.
Yeah, it's really hard to avoid touching it, but it's important to do so. I guess the most important thing I would say is if you've got a rash near your eye, you do need to get checked out both by your doctor and by an ophthalmologist. Sometimes one of the more common complications is an entity called herpes zoster ophthalmicus. And basically that's when the shingle starts to affect the nerves innervating your eye, and that can cause visual loss if it's not aggressively treated. So try not to touch it, but certainly if it's near your eye, don't take chances. Just go to your doctor, go to your eye doctor, get checked out.
Mary in Madison, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a 39-year-old who had shingles on my face this year, and it was not in my eye, thank goodness, but it did go all the way from my lower jaw up to my scalp and in my ear. It was a pretty severe case. I am wondering about eligibility for the shingles vaccine and also concerned about the potential Guillain-Barré side effects because I did have some lingering nerve issues for quite a while.
Yeah. So, first of all, I'm really sorry. That's a really unpleasant place to get shingles. That's unfortunate that you were dealing with it so young. In response to so your second question is, should I get the vaccine? I would definitely talk to your doctor about it. You know, as I mentioned, it's for people 50 and up, but if you have any history of immunocompromise or immunodeficiency, it can be given as for people over the age of 18. In response to your question about Guillain-Barré, that's kind of an interesting and tricky one. So there is concern that in some huge studies, slight increase in incidence of Guillain-Barré, which is basically an autoimmune, your immune cells start attacking your own nervous system, causing all sorts of really horrific symptoms and weakness and numbness and tingling. So it's associated very, very minutely with the shingle shot. But the problem is that shingles itself is also associated with Guillain-Barré. I definitely favor the vaccine. I think that it's safe and the risk is very, very small. And there's a known pretty profound risk of neurologic complications of shingles in some people. So great questions.
Mary, there you go. Thank you so much. What about covering, if you've got some the rash, is it okay or should you keep it covered with some gauze or whatever?
Yeah, definitely keep the rash covered. The key is really making sure that nobody's coming into contact with your open sores because there is live shingles virus in there, the VZV virus. And also just because you want to decrease the possibility of bacteria getting into those open sores because you can get these secondary bacterial infections of the rash, which are just as painful and, you know, need antibiotics to be treated. So keep it clean, keep it covered.
And how long typically does a rash last on your body?
Typically, most people will have the rash crust over by 7 to 10 days. It can take a little while for the scabs to fall off after that. Do not pick at them. Just leave them be. They will fall off on their own, even if they're ishy. But in a couple of weeks, most people will have full resolution of the rash.
I was remembering chickenpox days as kid when I scratched. My sister would never scratch. And, of course, she got some some marks on her face, even though she never scratched, where I didn't get any. She was really mad about that.
That's too funny. Oh, man. Life is not fair.
Life is not fair. And if you got shingles, life it was not fair to you. Dr. Laura, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have a chance to meet again.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Laura Feli, our guest, infectious disease physician at Amplify Health in La Crosse. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Amplify Health is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. So thanks to them for that as well. And thanks to you for listening. This and other shows are a team effort. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with our favorite outdoor writers. They're back to talk about current issues in nature and wildlife. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.